A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Welcome to A Tempo, the Classical Network spotlight on the arts and culture. I'm Rachel Katz, and I'm your host as we explore the changes at work in the performing arts. Each week, I'll bring you some of the latest news and also take time to examine many of the issues that are challenging these organizations and institutions. Today, I'll speak with the author of a new book that chronicles the rise, heyday, and ultimate demise of New York City opera. My guest will be Heidi Wellison, opera critic for The Wall Street Journal, whose book Mad Scenes and Exit Arias examines the factors that made New York City opera unique and the underlying pressures that dogged it throughout its existence. She'll share her thoughts on these issues and also on the directions that today's opera companies are exploring to sustain the art form into the future. As part of A Tempo, we're pleased to bring you some of the news from around the world of the performing arts. Musicians from Lyric Opera of Chicago have gone on strike after contract talks with management failed to reach an agreement on the length of the work season, a minimum core of musicians, and other compensation issues. The Chicago Tribune reported that the musicians launched the strike on Tuesday, leading the opera company to cancel all performances through its Saturday night opening this weekend. Management is looking to reduce the number of the musicians' work weeks to 22 from 24 and cut the so-called core orchestra to 69 from 74. According to the Tribune, the opera company revenue has fallen over the past 4 years as it raised less money through grants, contributions, and gifts, while costs have climbed. The musicians' contract expired on June 30th. In other opera news, Santa Fe Opera announced that it sold a record $10.3 million in tickets last season, almost 20% more than in the previous year, helped by demand for its mix of American and European classics and a healthy tourism economy in the region. In a statement, the opera company also reported an increase in contributions in the year ended September 30th, helped by support for its McKay Fund for debut artists that it says has exceeded expectations. The most recent season included company premieres of Leonard Bernstein's Candide and John Adams' Dr. Atomic. Last February, Robert Mayo was appointed general director, who in turn brought in Alexander Neef as its first artistic director and Harry Bickett as music director. And finally, the opera world is mourning the passing of Spanish soprano Montserrat Caballé. According to the New York Times, Caballé, who sang at the opening of the 1992 Olympic Games in Barcelona, died October 6 at the age of 85. Born in Barcelona, she got her first break at the Basel Opera when she stepped in to sing Mimi in 1956, made her Carnegie Hall debut in 1965, stepping in for Marilyn Horne, and then debuted at the Met later that year. Those are just some of the headlines this week from around the arts world. September 2013 was by no means the first time the fate of the New York City Opera hung in the balance. Throughout its 70 years, it had faced a series of ups and downs as it tried to secure its place, financially and culturally, in the New York and national opera scene. Its history was full of innovative successes and dismal failures as it attempted to navigate the financial and structural challenges facing it and many other opera companies. Its ultimate demise that October had its roots in a wide range of missteps and leadership challenges at a time when the entire cultural landscape of opera was shifting. Wall Street Journal opera critic Heidi Wellison explores this rich but tumultuous history in her new book, Mad Scenes and Exit Arias, The Death of the New York City Opera and the Future of Opera in America. It's published this month by Metropolitan Books. I met with Wellison recently to talk about some of the highs and lows of the opera company's existence, the challenges that faced its leaders, and some of the lessons that today's opera companies can glean from its experience as they chart new directions of their own. First of all, looking at the foundation, the creation of New York City Opera as the people's opera, there was a very specific reasons why it was created. In hindsight, or is it even fair to ask, was it based on a sound premise at the time?
I think it was based on a sound premise at the time. And as long as there were people in New York who wanted to see it, and enough backers who wanted to pay for it, it was fine. The interesting thing about City Opera in 1943 was that it was something completely different from what had been done in the United States at that time. The Met was a big, fancy operation with European singers and rich people, and the New York City Opera was about young singers and not rich people, and it was also producing producing opera that wasn't being done at the Met. And this had a lot to do with their own financial limitations, because they couldn't afford to have big, expensive singers from Europe. And the Ford Foundation bailed them out in 1957 to do American operas. So they started doing those kinds of unusual work. So City Opera became a really unusual and new kind of institution that didn't exist in the United States. It was really more like a small opera company in a small city in Europe. And we didn't have any of those at the time.
And also you mentioned, as far as the audience, there was a very distinct audience as well that they were attracting as well.
There definitely was. There was an immigrant audience. There were Italian, German, Jewish, Eastern European immigrants for whom opera was part of their cultural life. They had experienced it and enjoyed it back home in the home country. And so the immigrants and the immediate descendants of the immigrants, this kind of entertainment was something that they were interested in and that they were and that they wanted to see. And they weren't likely to go to the Met and dress up and be with all the fancy people. So the People's Opera actually made a kind of sense at that period.
What would you say were really some of the finest moments, at least in those early and middle years, of New York City Opera and what it accomplished?
Well, I mean, they did the first ever stage performance of Ariadne off Naxos. They did that before the Met did. They did a lot of contemporary operas that were commissioned or paid for by the Ford Foundation, like pieces like Lizzie Borden. There were a lot of those that were done that the Met certainly would never do. And then, of course, when we get, are we talking about the move to Lincoln Center as well in terms of accomplishments? I mean, that Giulio Cesare with Beverly Sills, that, you know, sort of, that was the first kind of burst of Baroque opera, but it certainly made Beverly Sills a big star. That was really important. And also Julius Rudel recruited a lot of very interesting American singers who were certainly not singing at the Met, starting with people like Norman Traigle, Beverly Sills. Well, both of those were actually before Julius, but they built their careers under his aegis. And then, you know, later on, others who came in who were really, really important, important singers who would not have gotten a start at the Met. They got their start at City Opera. Look at Plácido Domingo, who made his New York debut singing Rodrigo in 1966 at the New York City Opera. And I speak incorrectly. It was not his debut. I think he actually made his City Opera debut a year or two earlier, but that was when he was, when he really made a big splash. And then he was gone. You know, they couldn't get him back after that.
As it started to progress, what would you say really was the first instance of where perhaps there were signs that something would have to change, perhaps more so than at least initially people realized?
Frankly, I really think that, and I do talk about this in the book, the City Opera was really kind of a roller coaster of crisis and rescue from the get-go. I mean, mostly starting with that Ford Foundation bailout in 1957, they were almost, you know, they were going to go under. And, you know, that was the first one. And there were many others that, you know, that came later because, you know, basically, if you're only charging a very low ticket price, but you have artists who expect to be paid, your costs are going to get higher and your income is not going to get higher. So this was really an issue throughout the entire history of the company, but they always managed to find somebody or something to bail them out. So Beverly Sills was in a lot of trouble when she took over the company in 1979. And she was, I love the story that several people have told me about how Beverly Sills used to fly around the country. You know, she would leave on Monday and she would fly around the country collecting checks. And she would get back to the office on Friday and open her handbag and dump all the checks out onto the desk so that they could make payroll. And this was, you know, Beverly Sills said in her autobiography, from the moment I took over, I spent my entire time in life or death pursuit of money. And that's, you know, that's basically what she did. And because Beverly Sills was such a celebrity and also married to a very rich man who had a lot of rich friends, she was really able to get people on board to give her that money to bail them out. So under Beverly Sills for that 10 years, they really did manage to find themselves on a solid financial footing. They really never did after she left, because her ability to collect that money was not something that anybody who succeeded her was ever able to do.
And that's one thing that comes out in reading, is that there seems to be such a central role of specific personalities, both in terms of being able to maintain and continue the New York City Opera, but also then as it starts declining and facing crises, perhaps even precipitating issues or failing to see things and being such strong personalities that people aren't questioning them. How key were these individuals in particularly that destabilization and the ultimate demise of the opera company?
Well, I think the first thing that happened was that in the early 2000s, when there was real dramatic change in audiences, in that in particular, and in the costs of how the how much more expensive it was getting to operate the company, there were a couple of people. First, Paul Kellogg, who had a very interesting artistic point of view and did many interesting artistic things, such as the whole Baroque opera renaissance, which was a big deal for that company. But Kellogg really, he expected that if they raised the quality of City Opera, that the audiences would come flocking. And they didn't, actually. I looked at several charts that showed that the audiences actually continued to fall. So that obviously wasn't working. Kellogg really wanted to find a new theater for the company, and he thought that that was incredibly important. And he kind of changed the whole conversation away from, well, we really need to figure out how to make this company work and what are its real structural problems. How can we fix it? And his idea was, well, if we just get a new theater, then everything will be fine. You know, like, we won't have to compete with the New York City Ballet and everything will go along, you know, perfectly well. Well, that clearly was a real distraction, and the board got all involved in that. I think to the extent that they actually weren't looking at some of the other more pressing problems that were actually greater than the problem of the theater. Then, after Kellogg finally basically gave up, and announced that he was retiring, and Susan Baker took over as, well, that was actually before she took over in 2004. She took over as the board chair, and she was also very much part of this whole, like, let's find a new theater as the be-all and end-all of how we're going to save City Opera. And then she, you know, started looking around for trying to figure out how to save City Opera. And she happened on the idea of Gerard Mortier, because she sat next to him at a dinner and she thought, like, this is our savior. This is the person who's going to rescue us. And because she came to that conclusion without any real, any real evidence to back that up, I think that that was really the turning point for the downfall of the company, because basically she decided to do a 180 with that company. She decided to completely change what it was without really basically, number one, consulting anybody, and number two, raising the money to make it possible.
And following on that then, what would you say was possibly the New York City Opera's last missed opportunity?
I would say that when Mortier decided that he would not come, and that was a whole sort of cascade of disasters. But in 2008, when Mortier announced that they had offered him whatever it was, $36 million instead of the $60 million he'd been promised, and that was, you know, less than the smallest regional opera company in France, and of course he wasn't going to come and, you know, and do the city opera for that. Instead of finding somebody who might have been able to pull everyone together to find a way forward for the city opera that would bring all its stakeholders, like the board, the audience, the artists, Lincoln Center, and just say, this company is really valuable, it's really important, and it needs to survive, and we all need to pull together and enable it to survive. Instead of hiring a person like that, they hired George Steele, who, for all, you know, whatever his good intentions were, really had absolutely no connection with opera companies. He had never run one. I mean, he had briefly been in Dallas, but that was a very, very short moment of his career. And he was not really the sort of person who could make that whole sort of group of people come together and rescue the company. So that, I think, was the pretty much the last straw.
Even with its uniqueness, the opera company, certainly as it started to struggle and face so many structural issues, in some ways there are shades of it basically reflecting opera in America overall. How would you say that it does reflect where opera started, came, and is heading?
Like all the performing arts in this country, opera started out having a constituency, and it was an important part of the, you know, the cultural life. And I think that now, with a much wider range of entertainment opportunities and different kinds of things that people like to do. I mean, you used to buy your subscription to the symphony, and you, like, every Friday night, you know, 12 nights a year, you bought that subscription, or to the opera company, and you bought it in advance, and that's what you did. That people don't do that anymore. And there's so many other possibilities and options of things that people can do, that just running an opera company or an orchestra in the same way that you always ran it for all these years, based on this repertory system, you know, like with many, many weeks of performances, and expecting people to be repeat consumers, it doesn't really work anymore. And as a result, I think that all of these institutions really have to look at their structure and say, well, how do we keep these great works of the performing arts going and enable us to, you know, continue to perform them and to refresh the repertoire, which I also think is really important. But how do we need to change the structure of the institutions that present these things in order to make them financially possible? And, you know, in theory, if you had, like, you know, some very rich person, like, you know, if Mayor Bloomberg in the time of the City Opera had decided, well, this company is really, really important, and yes, I'll give them, like, you know, $50 million, and, you know, they can invest that, and then they can, you know, survive, then, you know, you could actually use the, you know, the old model. But I think more and more companies, particularly those that are working on those old repertory models, are finding that this is really impossible. I write in the book about how, you know, what the San Francisco Opera did to kind of revamp its relationships with its, you know, with its labor unions in order to make them, you know, more sustainable going forward. The Lyric Opera of Chicago is in, you know, in labor negotiations now. And, you know, I looked at their numbers from, you know, like some years ago, and it looked to me like they, you know, they were going to have some real problems there. So, you know, it's not just the New York City Opera. The New York City Opera did have the issue of being the second company in New York. So the, you know, the richest people obviously were going to support the Met, but the problems within its structure that made it ultimately crumble, are pretty general to other kinds of opera companies and orchestras, certainly all over the United States.
Towards the end of the book, it actually takes a fairly positive, forward-looking take as far as some of the opera companies that are finding ways to succeed. Many of them certainly are new, so we'll see how they develop in the near future. But you've mentioned, for example, Opera Philadelphia, with now two O festivals behind them, Beth Morrison projects. Today, what is going into the successes that some opera companies and opera collectives are finding?
Well, you mentioned Opera Philadelphia, which I think is, you know, kind of my poster child for the future of opera, which is not to say that everybody and that every single opera company should look at Opera Philadelphia and say, oh, let's do that. We'll have a 10-day festival and then two stagioni operas, you know, later on in the season, and that will solve our problems. Opera Philadelphia did not do that. They spent 5 years and some really, really, really serious market research to look at their audience, to look at their product, and to figure out what it was that they thought would make their company make their company a survivor. I mean, they looked at the potential, potential of going out of business. And they said, okay, well, we can't keep going down this road. We have to do some real analysis, and we have to do some very serious fundraising. And they did all of those things. And I think that getting their entire board on, you know, their entire board on board, if you like, raising a lot of money, getting their audience interested, reaching out to a broader audience that was, you know, outside of Philadelphia in order to make this successful. And the first two festivals, the first one I know was financially very successful. I don't know about the second one. I haven't heard anything about those numbers yet. But from, you know, I was there and it looked like it was doing really well. Certainly there's a lot of buzz around it and there's a lot of interest around it. And so, I mean, it seems to me that you've got to look at your community and you have to figure out, you know, what niche it is that you can fill and what your artistic vision is for, you know, for filling that niche, because you need both those things. You can't just say, okay, well, you know, like we're going to fill a niche. You have to have an artistic point of view in order to make that work.
Mm. You know, and there has been a trajectory from, you know, initially around the time it had been founded, when major companies were few and far between. We saw proliferation in other cities, smaller regions, and also to the point where nowadays, in line with what we're seeing in the music world at large, with a much more entrepreneurial startup sentiment, what trajectory or trajectories do you see opera going, and what are the opportunities for where people can go to see opera in the near future?
Well, that's actually one of the most interesting things that I think is happening now. It's almost as though, you know, something like the New York City Opera is like the giant oak that falls down, and then all these little sort of small saplings kind of spring up around it. So, like, if you look at New York City and the places and the kinds of opera that are going on, or you have something like Heartbeat Opera, where they'll take a classic title and rethink it, not just in terms of its production style, but will also do a different musical arrangement for it and, you know, make cuts and make changes and sort of play around with it for a different audience. That's a really interesting aspect. There's Beth Morrison Projects, which you mentioned before, which does all new work, really sort of fascinating range of things, some of which you might not even consider to be opera at all, but always something interesting. There's Opera at the Catacombs, which is really wild, where you go out to the Greenwood Cemetery in Brooklyn and and see the Rose Elf, being performed in a catacomb in the middle of a cemetery. I mean, and that's something that, you know, only a very small amount of people, you know, can attend. So, you know, that's something that's very interesting. The other thing that I think is kind of significant, and this was something that I really noticed was that when the Berlin Philharmonic brought the stage St. Matthew Passion to New York and did it in the Armory, and they basically reconstructed the Berlin Philharmonie concert hall within the Philharmonic, and then there was this amazing performance directed by Peter Sellers with the, the St. Matthew Passion was staged, and the singers were sort of wandering around in the audience and interacting with the orchestra members, which wasn't the first time that had been done. I mean, Jonathan Miller, of course, did that too. But this, the thing about the Berlin Philharmonie event was that I think they had about two performances. They were selling them for tickets were like $100 a pop. They sold out, I think even before it went on sale. So then they opened the dress rehearsal and they sold $100 tickets for that. And that sold out immediately. So this is these event sort of based things that become what people want to see. Or you had to see the mile long opera on the High Line because that was an event and it's only happening for a small amount of time, or you had to see this thing from Berlin. Those sort of one-off things have also become a really important part of the ecosystem. And I think that it makes it very difficult for a company like even the Metropolitan Opera, and certainly like City Opera, to have, month in and month out, you're doing 28 productions and 275 performances, and here's someone who's coming in, or some operation that's coming in, and they're doing two performances, and it's just the most happening thing. How do you, as a repertory operation, maintain that level of excitement and interest so that you can sell, say, if you're the Met, 4,000 seats, 8 performances? I mean, it's really hard. I'm hoping that people will read this book as both a cautionary tale, but that they will also understand what's possible, that you can remake an opera company. You don't have to do everything the same way and hope it'll just work out. Like Opera Philadelphia, you can sort of go back and look at your operation and say, this company is worth preserving. We really want to do this. And what do we have to do in order to preserve it for the future? And I think that people can do that if they're careful and thoughtful and they believe in what they have. And I hope that people will read this not as just this, sort of soap opera of crisis and rescue and destruction. And though, of course, that's kind of what it is, but that they will see that there's hope for the art form and for the institutions that produce it.
That was my conversation with Heidi Wellison, opera critic at the Wall Street Journal. Her new book, Mad Scenes and Exit Arias, The Death of the New York City Opera and the Future of Opera in America, was published this month by Metropolitan Books. You can hear additional excerpts of our conversation on the A Tempo page of our website at wwfm.org. I hope you enjoy these conversations that I bring you, focusing on the changing dynamics and challenges in the arts world each week on A Tempo. But remember that programs like this are made possible only through your support of this station. To become a member of the Classical Network, go to wwfm.org and click on Donate. Thank you for your support of the Classical Network. Thank you for listening to A Tempo. I'm your host and producer, Rachel Katz. Join me again next week as we explore more issues and trends in the world of the performing arts. A Tempo is a production of the Classical Network and is made possible by the support of listeners like you.